by Joe.
Art McCurdy was the editor of the Roswell newspaper, and we were in Roswell several years ago, and this interview that we made with him was one of the last he did, actually. I think it was 3 years ago or four. And first of all, I'd like to thank Charles Fisher, editor of the Roswell Daily Record, who told me about Art passing away, Art McCurdy. And by the way, the Roswell community is so lucky to have a publisher like Charles Fisher. He's open to all issues and all sides, and he's got one heck of a newspaper. So let's go ahead and listen to this interview recorded in Roswell, New Mexico.
Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and we're broadcasting from Roswell. We are at the Convention Center, and we have a 91-year-old man here who actually is not old at all, Art McCurdy. Welcome to the show.
The 7th of July in 1947, I was editor of the morning newspaper, the Roswell Morning Dispatch. We had a small paper, but nevertheless, we were out 6 days a week, and I've often laughed and said Roswell back in after World War II was a fanatic baseball town. The men of the town just loved professional baseball, followed it religiously, So that was our excuse for being a newspaper. I ran the box scores on the front page of the dispatch every day because the guy's radio wasn't even that good right after the war. Mm-hmm. And so the guys they wanted to know what happened in the baseball games. Mm-hmm. They had a circulation of about 5,000 then, an old flatbed press that was 50 years old and sheet-fed and the hot metal shop, and obviously. So it was pretty quiet, and then about 11 o'clock that morning, Walter Hawk, the public information officer at the base, or PR guy at the base, brought a two-paragraph press release in, and basically, and I don't remember it because, well, anyway, it said basically that wreckage of an unidentified flying object had been found on a ranch 45 miles north of Roswell, and it had been brought into the Walker Air Force Base. What happened, two nights before the 7th, there was a giant electrical storm north of town. We had one just the other night here, as a matter of fact. And it put on a good show for a while. Mm-hmm. And this old sheepherder who was up on the ranch up there, it wasn't his ranch, he was just literally, but nevertheless, well, a decent man. Mm-hmm. He was used to thunder and lightning, but there was a particularly loud explosion, and he just assumed it was part of the electric storm. But the next day, when he went out in the pasture, he began to pick up pieces of something he'd never seen before. Well, I mean, see, that was on the 5th of July. It was on the 6th that he started picking up this stuff. And I don't know how much of it he took. None of us ever got a chance to see the wreckage, except Jesse Marcells, the intelligence officer at the base. And I don't know what they called him back in those days in the Army Air Corps. But he took it over and showed it to his neighbors three or four miles away, maybe 5 miles away, and they said, you ought to take this in and take it to the sheriff because this could be something that somebody might be interested in. And I'm paraphrasing, I don't know what the name. They advised him to take it into George Wilcox, the sheriff, and he didn't get around to it till that afternoon on July. No, he got it around to it that afternoon of July the 6th, and the sheriff called the Army Airfield and.
I guess that's how Jesse Marcel got involved.
So he came in kind of after work to pick this stuff up, and the story that we had, that the stuff he had were pieces of what looked like aluminum foil, but they, as near as I could tell, he had them. The pieces he had were in a box. I mean, you know, like so. Well, he took the box home that night, and he's a little boy. Played with the stuff, and they took a cigarette lighter and tried to light it, and it wouldn't burn, and you could crimp it, and it would stamp right back. And so he assumed they had something, that it was off of a crash site out 45 miles north of Roswell, and perhaps it was, I don't know whether he ever related it to an unidentified flying object or not. After he got it from the sheriff, but he didn't take it out to the base till the next morning. And when they started looking at it out there, they said, well, look, this has got to be, considering this, how it happened, the explosion or the thunderclap, this has got to be wreckage of an unidentified flying object. Maybe, I don't know whether he had seen anything or not. I just don't know. But Walter Haught was the basic publicity director, whatever they called him. Anyway, Walter and Butch Blanchard, the commanding colonel out at the base, put together this little two-paragraph press release. Well, we had two radio stations in Roswell and the two newspapers, and I was the morning paper, so I always got the press releases from the Army Air Base last, because I didn't go to press till 12 o'clock at night.
Right.
Well, an awful lot of the good news stories broke around 5 in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. So you had more stories.
Well, we got them, that's another, I could talk for a half an hour about my fight with the Associated Press.
Yeah.
And the general manager of this AP in Dallas, I said, the governor of Texas can go to the bathroom, we'll get 5 inches. If the president can get shot, we'll get a paragraph from those guys over in Dallas. I was always fighting with them. But anyway, Walter had a good friend who was a part owner and an announcer on the new radio station, so he took the press release to him first. And this guy was not any dummy. He immediately called the Associated Press in Albuquerque, and they put it on the international radio. I'm a national radio.
You're right.
And I started getting telephone calls before I'd even gotten the press release. Walter finally got around to me about 11 o'clock. But it was a very exciting news day for me, because I talked to all three of the daily papers in London. I talked to Paris Match. I talked to... I don't remember all of them now, but I spent pretty much the whole day answering the phone. If calls were coming from all over the world, and I thought about it later, and I realized that even though that was 1947, the Cold War was beginning to heat up a little bit, and people were worried to death about what was going on between the Soviets and the Americans. And... plus the fact that there had been multiple sightings of flying saucers reported, mostly out of the United States, but in other countries as well. So people were thinking about these things, and so when the word came out that wreckage of one had been found in this little small city in New Mexico, It triggered an awful lot of excitement
around the world.
Around the world,
mm-hmm.
And Walter called me, that called all four of us about 1 o'clock that afternoon, and he said, don't throw that press release away. I got to come pick it up because that wasn't wreckage of a flying saucer at all. It was the remains of a weather balloon. And I had been a Navy pilot for 4 years in the Pacific, and we didn't spend much time with $25 weather balloons, yep. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
And we just flew when we had to. But I didn't know what had... I didn't have any idea really what it was, but and I'll try to talk fast. I don't want to take up your time, but the story was a gigantic story the day it broke, and it was the next day it was a dead story. It was the darndest phenomenon in newspapering for me. Because it was exciting, and then it was dead. And what I know happened.
Yeah.
And the rest is conjecture on my part, because I'm kind of an amateur astronomer, and we darn near find a new thing out in space every week. It seems like.
We're talking with Art McQuinty, who was the editor of the newspaper in 1947 and was there when the UFO incident happened here in Roswell. But Art, you were more than just a newsman. You became friends with quite a few of these people, including Colonel Blanchard, right?
He was a very close friend of mine, and I'll just relate briefly. I flew PBYs in the Navy, a twin engine amphibious bomber.
Yes, I know.
And by the end, by middle of 1945, we were doing almost exclusively air sea rescue. My squadron had been on Midway, and one of our guys had been one of the fellows that found the Japanese fleet on the 5th of May in 1942 when they had the big fight.
Yeah, right.
And I think it was the battle that changed the whole war, because we sank three of their carriers. But I wasn't there, but my squadron was out there. And so I was five of us, five crews, five planes. We were sent up to Iwo Jima, and we were doing air sea rescue of the B-29s to Japan. And people don't realize those B-29s were getting shot down, too. They don't. We were down on Guam, I'll never forget it, in a Quonset, a big Quonset hut, and Curtis LeMay was there. He was commanding general of SAC. I don't know why they call it SAC then or not, but later SAC. And he got up at the podium and said, and this was early when the B-29s had just really started coming to Saipan and Tinian. He said, you've been bombing at 30,000 feet and you can't even hit Japan from this day on. You're not going to go above 5,000 feet, and I want you to do a decent bombing job, and if some of you get shot down, this is a war. And that's darn near verbatim what he said. He was a tough guy, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So we were dumboing the guys up to, and by that time we had one of us at 100 miles, one of us at 200, a destroyer at 300, a submarine in Tokyo Bay. If the guys got their engine shot out, if they could get out and get away from Japan, we had a pretty darn good chance to save them. And in the course of that, I had saved, I don't say saved, but I had found guys that had to ditch. And one of them, particularly close to Chichijima, which worried all of us, we had to circle him all night because we couldn't land and pick him up. The weather was bad, and there was the closest destroyer was going to take him about 8 hours to get over to pick him up. But this created helped make my friendship with Butch Blanchard a really good friendship, and plus the fact that he was a delightful guy, and I liked him a lot. And being an old Navy pilot, I mean, you know, Weeks later, seems like weeks, it probably was not even a month, he and I were in the bar of the Officers Club late one night. You know all these stories. And every time we were together, I said, come on, Butch, now tell me what really happened. I said, I know about the nurse and Glenn Dennis, and I know about the 100 guys that went out there and walked through the pasture, and I know that you closed the highway between Vaughan and Roswell for 2 days, I said, I know all about those things. He said, I don't talk about that. But that night he said, well, I'll tell you this. I saw something I've never seen before, and I hope I never see again. Mm-hmm. Well, I sobered up in a minute. You know, I was really...
You had a story, obviously.
I thought I did. And he said, I shouldn't have said that. I'm not supposed to talk about any of that. And he said, I got my ass in a
He was talking about the press release, right? I mean... well, he might have got in trouble there, but he was able to go on up the ladder and become a 4-star general before he passed away.
But he never would talk about it. And it's hard to keep track of in a time period like that. But later, there was a story in the New York Times, a national story. He had been in Moscow, Russia, and had gotten into a drinking contest with some Russian pilots, and he said he could outdrink them, and he did. He drank about a gallon of vodka or something, according to this story. And I thought to myself, that's Blanchard if I ever knew him. He was a delightful guy.
And you guys called him Butch, right? I
mean, yeah, his name was Bill, but he was kind of, you know, short haircut and all that, and he'd been skipper of the 509th, I guess, and I'd saved some of the... Some of the crews I saved were from the 509th. And
you have anyone else talk to you about it?
Well, not really.
Not on the record, of course.
Nobody would even talk to me. And I didn't pursue it that diligently because they say the story died so fast. But I don't know. Glenn Dennis now is pretty ill, so I doubt that you... I don't know whether you met
him. I know Glenn.
Well, if you know Glenn, you know the kind of person he is.
Yes.
Yeah, and nobody that was involved in any of this after Glow made any money out of it. There wasn't any con jobs going on or guys coming in saying, yeah, I saw one. They got out and they shook hands with me. There was no lying going on as far as I know. And I love Glenn's story, you know, goodness sakes.
And he always stuck with that story, too.
Well, it was a true story.
Yeah.
He's sitting down there at the funeral home, and the nurse he's been going with calls and asks if they have children's caskets. And he said, I don't know. I'll go up in the attic and see. And he said, I'll call you back. And she said, no, Glenn, I'm on a phone where you can't call me back. She said, I'll just hold. He came back, and he said, well, we have 3 children's caskets. And she said, well, bring them out. But don't take them to the hospital. She said, I'm in another building, and when you get here, if I'm not out there, just put them on the grass and get away as fast as you can. You don't want to be involved in any of this. He didn't know what she was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe Glenn. None of us, and you know about as much as I know anyway, but none of us had any reason to try to amplify it or make something out of it. It just wasn't that kind of...
Did you know the nurse?
No, I had never met her.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know Glenn that well then. I mean, I later was married to a Roswell girl. She and Glenn were in the same class in high school, and he and I did become good friends. And he was quite a talented sculptor. He made miniature sculpts like Raj Assen over at the museum, and he had a very good farm
Were you still in Roswell when they opened up that museum, or you'd already?
Well, I would.
I know you got out of journalism later and got a real job.
Yeah, I got a real job.
Just teasing. I've been in this field all my life.
And, we were married in 1949 and we moved to Los Angeles in 1950, mm-hmm. and I went into a new field called public relations, you know, like probably called corporate publicity for years of it. But basically, it was a new kind of corporate field and a kind of government information field for, and they were looking for how I got into it. Jack Campbell, who was later governor of the state, came by the dispatch office one day and said, I'm going, I knew Jack casually, he was in a good law firm here, Atwood Malone and mm-hmm. Campbell. And Ross Malone, again, I'm digesting to divert, but Ross Malone was later vice president and general counsel of General Motors. And the youngest president of the American Bar Association they've ever had. And here he is, a Roswell lawyer and a delightful guy. And Jack said, anyway, he said, I'm running the Oil and Gas Association here, and he said, I'm going back to private law practice, and the association is looking for what they call public relations, and they're trying to hire newspaper editors to do it. Would you be interested in the job? And I said, well, how much does it pay?
Right.
I'm getting ready to get married, so I left the paper and became secretary of the New Mexico Oil and Gas Association, which basically, fundamentally, the job was lobbying in the legislature. And at that time, you didn't have to have a pass or anything. There were only three of us.
Yeah, you could just go see anybody, right?
Yeah, well, there were three of us that were lobbyists. The vice president of Kennecott Copper from Silver City was their lobbyist, and then the Nature Pass had a lobbyist, and that we were it. So,
Art, you were an eyewitness to history back in 1947, and you've had plenty of time to think about it. You really believe something happened out there. I mean, an ET, a flying saucer.
As we talked about this around town after the fact, Barbara and Bob Anderson, our local billionaire, they stopped their car coming back from Santa Fe one day and watched a flying saucer. And another oil man, Bert Murphy, and his wife Martha, very, very dependable people. He had his own little private plane. They were coming back from Artesia and stopped twice to look at see flying saucers. And probably the most conservative guy in Roswell owned a hardware store, Wilmot Hardware Store, and Hinton Wilmot was rocking on his front porch and saw a flying saucer.
So they were around.
Well, reputable people were so people. You know, Bob Anderson spent his life in an airplane after he was chairman of Atlantic Richfield, and I've never talked to Barbara about it, but. He told me about it once, and such as it was, but it was I just happen to believe that it's
you're convinced it's real, right?
Periodically, you'll see a little squib. Now, as recent as sometime last year, they had multiple sightings down off of Perth, Australia. Well, that's the end of the world. If you know where Perth is, I mean, God, it
makes Roswell look like a real urban area.
Well, it makes Roswell. They're just way down on the other side of Australia, all by themselves, mm-hmm. and wouldn't be a bad place to be. As a matter of fact, Roswell's not a bad place. Basically, that's what little I know about it. But we had a secretary or. Vice President, Chairman of the paid employee of the Roswell Chamber of Commerce, and he had been out at the base, enlisted man, and he was one of the 100 that they took up and walked through the pasture. He said, had their arms linked together, so looking for more wreckage, and
So that's a lot of effort to look for a weather.
Well, there was then a lot of efforts to look for a damn $25 weather.
And I think with that, we'll leave the. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.